This is Scott Allen from odecoded.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Coon from lazycoder.com.
Hello and welcome to Herding Code. This episode is being recorded on March 12th, 2009. Tonight we're talking to Scott C. Reynolds about Mac and Objective-C development and anything else that we can learn about in the .NET world. So, Scott, do you mind introducing yourself?
Sure thing. My name's Scott C. Reynolds. I'm by day a .NET developer and manager for a healthcare company, and by night a prolific Twitterer. I blog at lostechies.com and scottcreynolds.com, and lately I've been expanding my world into Mac development and Ruby development.
So what kind of got you into that? I know you develop in the Windows world. Was it just kind of you wanted to kind of look around and learn some new things?
That was pretty much the driver, was to expand my horizons, so to speak. You know, whatever reason, in a bad economy, it's good to expand the resume, but also get a good idea of what's going on in other platforms and other languages and see how other people are doing things. Maybe see if I can get some new ideas.
So you wrote a really good blog post recently that just is called Beginning Objective-C for the C-sharp Guy. And I thought that was a really kind of good run through of some of the things. One thing that was a little bit off-putting was that when I started looking at it was that there's a huge amount of, you know, if you come into it expecting something kind of similar to C-sharp, there's quite a lot of syntactic differences. Pretty much even just a method signature looks nothing like a C-sharp method signature. So is it kind of like that all the way down, or is it kind of like once you get the syntax, it's mostly similar?
Well, it's similar in as much as they're both at some level C-based, though Objective-C is much, it's just one step above C, whereas C-sharp is now several steps above C. They're both object-oriented, but there are significant syntax differences and typing differences. Objective-C is dynamically typed, which is not something we're strictly used to in the C-sharp world. And Objective-C is a message-passing language, not a method-calling language. So that's another new thing to get used to, and that's why your method signatures look very strange in Objective-C.
So by messages, is this kind of, I mean, in the Windows world, messages, I think of like the Windows API, you know, you send a message to the API, and if somebody's listening for it, they'll respond and do something. More than one person can listen for a message, and it's kind of, it's not going to throw an exception or anything if you call a message and nobody responds. Is that kind of similar? I mean, almost like an event in C-sharp?
It can be seen that way, and Objective-C has that same deal going on like Windows messages with you can shoot off a message to everyone, and if someone wants to do something with it, then they can. You can send a message to an object that maybe doesn't respond to it, and that object has the opportunity to pass it along if it wants to, or ignore it, or throw an exception. But the idea is that you are sending these messages to the objects rather than saying, object, I'm calling a method directly on you. So it's more like a pass-off, you know, a handoff versus a direct call.
So what does that let you do that's different in the C-sharp world? Like, you know, because you've got this different capability, how does it encourage you to write your programs differently?
Well, for one thing, it lets you be totally dynamic in how, you know, you don't know what's going to happen until runtime, essentially. And that's going to sound a little scary to people. But so in Objective-C and in Ruby, where we have the same thing going on, you can define extensions to a class at runtime and have them handle new types of messages if that's what you want. You can pass things along down the chain in ways that would cause you compiler errors if you were doing C#. So it allows you to kind of unbind your code and uncouple it a little bit even. I guess decouple is a better word than uncouple.
Well, I had a question that was kind of related to that, which is before the call, I downloaded the Cocoa Fundamentals Guide, and I thought it was kind of interesting. By the time you got to chapter 4, it was already talking about the design patterns that are in play, and it's listing things like adapter and chain of responsibility and command and decorator and model view controller. I just thought that was interesting compared to your typical experience with WPF or Silverlight or Windows Forms. You just don't see that stuff in Chapter 4. It's in the graduate level class.
Yeah, I you see that with quite a few of the documentation things around Cocoa, both with the structure of the programs and things like the human interface guidelines. You know, Apple really wants you to conform to some kind of accepted standards in the Apple community to building usable applications, and it's just stuff that we don't see like on the MSDN docs.
So how did those design patterns play into your development, day-to-day development?
Well, MVC really, I think, is the one that stands out the most, and that's because Cocoa development using Interface Builder, which is the tool that allows you to create UI elements, forces you into MVC. A new person to Cocoa cannot download Xcode and start writing all kinds of code behind in their WinForms files like we can and are sometimes encouraged to in Windows development. With the Cocoa framework and using Interface Builder to create your interfaces, your user interfaces, you completely separate the back-end code and the concerns of rendering UI. And for a while, I didn't even, it was totally magic to me how it even wired it up. You have to go digging pretty deep to understand where it's happening. It's not like what we do in C# sometimes where in the code we would say, you know, button.new, button.click plus equals event handler, etc. So it really encourages you to separate those concerns right out of the box. And I think that's kind of the most in-your-face example of where the two worlds are different.
That and the fact that Interface Builder works in terms of allowing you to design your interface graphically without having to, you know, drop down and write, you know, a kind of UI code or XAML. At least that's been my experience. Every time I've tried to write XAML code, whether it's Silverlight or WPF proper, I've always had to eventually load up the source and start dealing with angle brackets. And, you know, you just can't do that with Interface Builder. You can do it in the controller, or you can write subclasses for UI elements, but you package up your nib and go on there.
So is that because you don't have, like, there's no, like, in Blend or whatever, you're designing, you're using a designer, but you're creating XAML code, which, like you said, you can go in and edit it. With Interface Builder, is what you're building like a binary format that you can't get to? Or, I mean, how is it different than the kind of XAML, Silverlight, WPF world?
It's not quite a binary. Let me look it up so I don't get it wrong.
You can get to it. I don't know if the whole thing is contained here, but there is an XML formatted file that gets kind of hidden in there somewhere that'll show you almost like in XAML or in, say, the form class of C#. It'll show you like what you've created in terms of what objects exist on the view. But it's not right there in your face like it is with WPF or WinForms. It's very hard to find, and you're ill-advised to try to mess with it.
I think that's one thing that I've had trouble understanding, and I'm not sure I do completely yet, is that, you know, like, the WPF world is not, like, it still in some ways encourages draggy-droppy behavior, but you can do more MVC-based development and people are moving to that with MVVM and that sort of thing. So and then you've got your interface defined in XAML. And so I'm wondering, is it just a difference in the languages, or is there a lot more, you know, in the file type that expresses your view, or is it like there's a lot more going on, it's under the hood and technically? Do you know what I'm asking about?
There is a bit going on under the hood technically. I think it's a combination of that and the tooling kind of enforcing that hardcore separation. And that's not a bad thing. I was talking to another Mac developer who I was asking him about the concept of like an IOC container, because it's something that I still haven't come across in the Objective-C Cocoa world. But the interface builder almost acts like an IOC container. And when the nib loads up, it kind of unpacks everything it needs and just goes, and it does all that for you. So it's not something that you're necessarily wiring up in the code. Like, you still end up doing, you know, when you say wire up an event in WPF or WinForms, you still end up with code that's right there in your editor that you're interacting with sometimes. And, you know, anytime you're doing anything beyond what you can just drag onto the design surface, you end up going and editing that code by hand anyway. And that's just not something that happens with Interface Builder. It's not something that's normal.
One thing in WPF or in XAML is this concept of bindings. And, you know, you've got one-way and two-way bindings, and you're kind of encouraged to bind to something that's going to be set. So you'll set like a data context or whatever, and then you'll bind and you'll load from that. And, you know, part of me, and I, anyone that's, you know, done like Visual Basic development, you know, back in the day or whatever, you're kind of like taught, like, don't use data binding because it gets you into all kinds of problems and it's very rigid. But what I'm seeing with WPF is it really is kind of like more of a mature pattern. Is it similar, or do you have data binding kind of behavior from, you know, from your, I don't know what you call it, your nib, whatever, but, you know, and then it's set by the controller, you know, I mean, that it bind, or is it pushed into it, or does it pull from the view? Do you know what I'm saying? Is that just the dumbest question ever? I can take that.
it's a good question, and it's kind of similar, not really in how it works, but in the concept. And I'm still not under the hood 100% sure how everything works. But in the interface builder, when you work with the view, you can define actions that sort of like events, if you think of it that way, but not really. And basically what it boils down to is it's saying that I'm going to, it's defining a contract, essentially. I'm going to be either listening for or talking about this message. And then in your actual implementations in your controllers, you use NS actions, I believe, off the top of my head, or IB actions, that's what they're called, interface builder actions, and IB outlets to define the interaction points between the front end and the back end. So it's a similar concept, it's just implemented differently.
So one thing that I noticed that took me a while to kind of wrap my head around, and I'm still kind of a noob at them, is Cocoa bindings. And I'm not talking about like binding to IB outlet or IB action, because that's just kind of wire up code. But the way that you can do kind of key value bindings, which does two-way bindings in Cocoa. Have you either you or Kevin gotten to do much with that? You know, I've kind of done it when Core Data first came out, and I haven't really, you know, done much with it since. I got distracted by too many shiny things, like babies and things. But there was one of the things that kind of, that at the time, like 3 years ago or so, there wasn't really anything like it in .NET. I mean, you had data bindings, but they never really worked quite right. And you always had to kind of manually massage them, it seemed like to me, in .NET and WinForms and things. But it seemed like the Cocoa bindings really worked well and were really easy to set up and use. I don't know. Maybe I'm just rambling.
Well, the and I have not played too much with this aspect, but the Cocoa bindings, my understanding of them is that they kind of follow along our .NET view of maybe what data binding should be. And they are a way to kind of bind from your model to your view, but it's still there's an enforced separation where the controller is still the glue there. So the binding, there's like a two-way binding between the model and the controller, and then another two-way binding between the controller and the view, and the controller kind of is the go-between there.
And so is that all configured then with code? Like, in other words, in your controller, you wire up and you say bind to this and bind to this, and, you know, or is that set up in Interface Builder? Where do you actually go to set up a binding?
Well, part of it is set up in Interface Builder. It's basically like bind to, and then part of it is, I believe, set up in the controller. But now we're starting to get into an area that I'm not all that super comfortable with at this point.
One thing you mentioned, this NS, and every time I read anything about Mac development, everything's always NS this and NS that. Where does that come from? You know, do you know why everything's prefixed with NS?
I believe it's next step. Yeah. next step was like the precursor to the Interface Builder.
Okay.
That whole framework.
Okay, that makes sense. Back from the old next, which...
Well, yeah, next step was the precursor to the modern OS X, or OS X. I don't want the Apple guys leaving comments again. It's OS X, not X. So there's two kind of prefixes you'll run into in Cocoa development, or in Mac development, let's say. You'll have NS, which are generally constrained to the Cocoa frameworks and Cocoa APIs. And then you'll have other prefixes called CF, which stands for, I think it's Core Foundation. And those will tend to be more the C kind of API calls in Carbon. And if you have a chance, God, I can't remember the guy's name, but if you Google for Cocoa and Carbon interactions, and this might be a little bit of a tangent, but there's an interesting way that they allow interop between the standard kind of Carbon C things and passing in Cocoa or Objective-C objects. A little bit more explanation there. Carbon is, I think, what they used to call the old Mac toolkit or toolbox. It was a set of APIs that were primarily in C, comparable to, you know, Win32. And that was the way that you wrote Mac code in like System 9 and System 8 and in previous ones. So there's kind of, so for example, more modern programs like Delicious Library and NetNewsWire and things like that are written primarily in Cocoa, which uses Objective-C and the Cocoa framework. Whereas older programs like Microsoft Word are primarily written using Carbon. And that's a little bit lower level. It's a little closer to the metal. So it's kind of the kind of ecosystem surrounding OS X as far as developers are concerned.
Kevin, you had a question or something?
Yeah, so one of the hallmarks of sort of modern, especially VM-based programming environments like Java and C# and .NET framework is these massive class libraries, you know, thousands of classes. And a huge part of the learning curve is just sort of learning how to navigate the framework and what is all is there. And I'm curious if Cocoa/Objective-C, you know, sort of has that as well, or if it's a sort of a smaller set of constructs that you're working with?
So far to me, it seems pretty big. Just like learning any other of these base class libraries. So Objective-C, the language, has its own libraries, and C does as well. And then Cocoa has all these other things. It's really kind of like, you know, it's really pretty analogous to .NET, I think. You know, there's the concept of, you know, like where .NET might have ADO, Cocoa has Core Data, and .NET has, I think I'm going to say the old name for it because I don't know the new one, but GDI Plus. Cocoa has Core Graphics, and there's just a whole world of things to learn. So there you don't get any help there.
Is there anything hugely different in the, you know, like the core OS functions that you've run into, you know, that were just like, so it, like, I know, for instance, like in the little bit of Linux development I've played with, there's just a huge difference in the like core media API stuff, you know, and like you, it's kind of like bring your own media stack kind of thing, you know, so I'm just wondering if there's anything, you know, like file access or any of that kind of stuff that's just hugely different.
What I've found so far is you know, your kind of run-of-the-mill stuff, file access and web or network resource access and stuff. It's not crazy. It's, you know, it has its own way of its own set of APIs, obviously, but there's nothing shocking or surprising about it. And what you get with Cocoa is a lot of what you get with .NET. You get some of that underlying, you know, the underpinnings of the OS are, you're shielded from that.
Just to expand on that a little bit, one of the things that the .NET tooling gives you, whether it be, you know, Visual Studio or something like Reflector, is, you know, sort of a lot of assistive tooling to help you kind of explore the class libraries, and IntelliSense helps you kind of figure things out as you go along. And how does the tooling compare from that perspective? I know, for example, in my very little bit of tinkering I did with the iPhone development stuff, the IntelliSense stuff actually seemed pretty decent, especially for sort of a C-based language. It was never very good in the Windows C world. But I was fairly impressed with its how sort of snappy and comprehensive it was. You know, you have all that stuff that you kind of take for granted in the .NET world.
Yeah, I found that it has everything that you would normally expect. You know, there's the in .NET we have the IntelliSense, and in Cocoa, Objective-C, we have, I think it's called CodeSense actually, and they're equivalent. They're the same. It's a little less obvious how to work with it right away if you're used to Visual Studio, but that's just an environment thing. You get the same equivalent of the MSDN library for the Cocoa stuff. Some people like one format over the other, but it's all there. So you can go exploring. You can actually, it seems to me to be a little bit easier from within Xcode to get to the documentation of, say, a type by, I believe it's Alt and click on the type, and it opens up the documentation window around it. So yeah, it's all there. I think going outside of that, you know, the stuff that's built into the tooling on Apple developer site is a world of information for all aspects of iPhone development, Mac development, the whole nine yards. And a lot of really well-written stuff. And we have a lot of that, you know, on the MSDN library as well. But I think one of the main differences is sort of something that I think it was Kay Scott was alluding to earlier, the kind of level of approach that they take in terms of guidance seems to be a little bit higher, actually, than we get from some of the MSDN stuff.
So I was thinking about that earlier when you were talking about MVC. Like, I think that there's a lot of, in the .NET world especially, there's kind of a lot of thought put into, you know, well, what are better patterns? And, you know, like, so some of the MSDN code is very simple and has, you know, a button click event does something on a form, and that's not good. So there, that kind of encourages some thought, you know, among developers who care about that kind of stuff about, you know, well, what is a better pattern? And some of that leads to kind of a variety of patterns and opinions, you know, like, well, I'm using, you know, whatever, I'm using MVP, I'm using MVC, I'm using this or that. Do you see in the Mac world that because, you know, the MVC approach is pushed, do you see a variety of approaches that people are looking at for application patterns? Or are people just kind of like, yeah, MVC works, this is the way to do it, and just go for it?
Actually, it's kind of funny. My exposure to the development community around Mac development, and granted, is still very young compared to how long I've been in the Microsoft community, but it's far more homogeneous. It's there's an idiomatic way to do everything. You know, nobody's talking about things other than doing MVC the way Interface Builder tells you to do MVC. And yeah, it's kind of interesting actually to see the differences in what the two different developer communities are talking about. I don't see a lot of talk, for instance, about dependency inversion and IOC containers in the Mac world, and sometimes it seems like that's all we talk about in the .NET world. Not that those things are bad, it just doesn't seem to be a first level concern of the Mac world.
Is some of that because the languages or the frameworks sort of don't really need it? Like, you know, people always say you don't really need IOC in Ruby because it's a dynamic language and, you know, you just pass in whatever you need to pass in. Or, you know, you don't need to do mocking or whatever. You know, is it that sort of thing? Or is it just that it hasn't entered the sort of sphere of that world yet?
Well, I haven't been in the world to make a total judgment on it, so I don't want to make your listeners angry, but I think a lot of it is the language, and, you know, we have a lot of different concerns between static languages and dynamic languages, so that's just going to be a natural side effect. I think some of it is the tooling, you know, not to beat a dead horse here, but if Visual Studio's visual part, the designer part, were more about forcing us into a UI separation pattern and less about, as some people have called it, system.draggy-droppy, we might not be having all those discussions about MVP and MVVM and MVC and everything else either. I think the tooling is certainly driving people toward a given path there. And it just so happens that the tooling in the .NET world drives you almost to a path of necessitating talking about those separation patterns.
What's the experience then? We talked a lot about the language, and we have talked a little bit about the development environment. How do you actually get started? Like, okay, so you've got your Mac, you're ready to start writing an application. You know, what's your development environment that you use, and where do you get it from?
You put in your OS X install DVD and you install Xcode, or you can get it from the Mac developer site or the Apple developer site. So if you don't have access to your CD, you can just go get it. And then you will have to go and download whatever the latest version of the framework is that's not on your DVD. And if you want to do iPhone development, you have to go to the developer Apple site and register and download the iPhone SDK, because that does not currently come packaged on the disk. But it is free. Even to do local iPhone development is free. You just you register for a free developer account. If you want to do actual commercial iPhone development, be able to put things on the App Store, deploy to your phone, then you need to pony up, I think it's $99 for that license. But $99 is as much as you spend compared to whatever you would spend on tooling elsewhere. And then Xcode is your baby. You launch it. It's your Visual Studio. That's where you're going to live. That's where you're going to write all your code. It's got project templates, just like you expect in Visual Studio for all the different languages that it supports. And then there are ways to plug into that. So, like, currently there's a Mac Ruby project type, but it's not packaged with Xcode, but you can go get it. It's maintained by people at Apple. And hopefully that will become a first level part of that soon, because it's a real interesting kind of way to do Cocoa development with Ruby. And yeah, just like Visual Studio, for the most part, you got a project list and files and you can build and you can run. The iPhone section is really nice because it's got an on-screen simulator that can simulate different versions of the iPhone OS that are available currently, so you can test on multiple versions. The simulator looks just like a real iPhone, or it looks better than mine, which is all cracked. And so the tooling is actually really pretty nice. The one thing I will say that I miss is ReSharper, the refactoring tools that we have in Visual Studio. Even the native refactoring tools in Visual Studio outpace what you have in Xcode. Although you do have some refactoring support, your basic stuff. But there isn't currently, I think this is probably the biggest problem in Xcode right now, and maybe it's something that's on their radar as more people start to get into this, especially with iPhone development. There's no plug-in model, or no public plugin model for Xcode. So, you know, anybody can write an add-in for Visual Studio. And lots of great ones have been written that are free. Lots of great ones have been written that are commercial. And that's something that's sorely lacking in the Xcode world.
What's the unit testing story there in terms of tooling, in terms of, you know, testing frameworks, all that sort of stuff?
The unit testing story that I've run into so far is OC Unit, which is packaged with Xcode 3. So that's kind of like the in unit of Mac development. And the syntax is a little different from what you might be used to if you do test driven development or any unit testing at all in a Microsoft world. It follows more of a convention-based thing, you know, whereas in .NET, we put most of our test tools, you put like a test attribute on a method, and as long as it's public void, then it's a test. And for OC Unit, everything starts with test if it's going to be a test, so there's a little bit of a convention over configuration thing going on there. But actually, one thing that's really cool about it is the way it works out of the box. You build OC unit tests separate from your project. You set up what's called a new build target, which is like a build configuration, really, where we might have debug, release, whatever. So you would have one for unit tests. And whenever you build, that fires off the unit test. So there is no building and not running tests like you can do with your .NET test runners. It runs as part of the build, and test failures are compiler errors in that configuration. So you can actually stop the build, you know, click on the failing test as if it's a compiler error and go right to it. You'll get the message and everything. So that's actually pretty neat.
And are the programming frameworks, the class libraries, sort of amenable to TDD style development, or, you know, heavily unit testing style, and is that style of development sort of in the Mac community?
I don't know. I think it's probably as much in the Mac community as it is in the .NET community, meaning, you know, some people are really doing it and a lot of people really aren't. But the code itself, you know, the language and the framework really supports a test-driven development workflow, maybe even more so than C#. You know, again, with the dynamic typing, there's less of the satisfying the compiler that you have to do. And I found that once I got over the hump of actually learning the syntax of how to write a test, my testing workflow was maybe a little bit faster in Objective-C than it was in C#.
So what's the installation thing on Mac? From what I understand, it's like you've got bundles that are just, it's a directory of kind of hidden files, and it looks like an app, and it's really kind of a lot cleaner than the whole MSI installer setup. Is that true? And also, can you talk about how that works in the iPhone, if it's different in the iPhone world? That's kind of a dumb question, right? Because that's all delivered via the store.
The iPhone stuff is all delivered via the store. You can deploy locally to your, like, to your own iPhone if you have a development iPhone, and that's just magic. It just pushes it to it and does whatever it needs to do, and now you have an icon on your iPhone desktop. In terms of the actual Mac install experience or deploy experience, the way the applications are packaged is definitely a lot cleaner than what you may end up with in Windows. I still remember, like, the first thing I ever installed on my MacBook Pro, I had no idea what was going on, because most, like, kind of the idiomatic way to install any application on a Mac is to bring up this window that has on the left side an icon, a nice pretty icon representing your application, and on the right side a shortcut folder to your applications folder, which is the Windows, you know, the Mac equivalent to C program files, and a little arrow from one to the other, and some of them will animate a dragging motion, and that's how you install. You just drag from the icon to the folder, and you're done. Most Mac apps don't really make you go through all the dialogues. They might make you do and accept a terms of use, but, you know, you rarely see one that's like, you want to do custom or do you want to do normal? And, you know, where do you want to install it to? And all those other questions that 99% of your users would rather not even see. So the install experience is clean, and it's actually one of the first things you really see when you start using a Mac that's different and kind of changes your perspective on how you are interacting with your users when you're deploying an app to them. And it's really kind of a fun thought experiment.
So Scott, when you're writing something on your Mac and you have a chunk of code, I'm wondering, how easy is it to take that code and move it over to the iPhone? Do you cross-compile things? What's the portability and what's the experience there?
Well, the iPhone environment is Cocoa Touch. iPhone and the iPod Touch both run on Cocoa Touch, which is a subset, and not necessarily a strict subset. It's just a smaller bit of Cocoa, kind of like .NET Compact Framework is a smaller bit of .NET, but there are some differences there based on the limitations of the device. So, for instance, in your regular Mac development with Objective-C 2.0, you have garbage collection. On the iPhone, you don't have garbage collection, so you have to manage your memory and very, very carefully. On the Mac, you don't have concerns necessarily about memory constraints, like, it would be rare that you would run out of memory on your MacBook, say. On the iPhone, you have to at all times be ready to respond to a low memory message from the system and do something about it. And I think the other big thing is that at any time, obviously, on an iPhone, someone could get a phone call. And you have to be ready at all times to have your state totally saved and that application exit, I think you get 4 seconds from the time the call is registered until the time the iPhone is going to take over, shut down your app, and change to the phone app. So it's kind of neat, actually, to think about these things when you're doing iPhone development. You know, you got to be taking every opportunity you can to save state so that your user can come back to it and it'll be like they never left. You have to take every opportunity you can to, you know, allocate memory only right when you need it and deallocate it as soon as you're done with it. And these are concerns that you really wouldn't have for regular Mac development. So I think you could probably port some code directly depending on what it did. But the concerns are fairly different between the two environments.
At a recent Macworld, I remember Steve Jobs showing off something about, or with the iPhone V2, and one of the things that they were talking about was the way that it had resident apps had a way of you could push stuff down to the application rather than the app having to run all the time and pull. Do you know what I'm talking about there?
Yeah, I think you're talking about the fact that the iPhone has no sort of background app support.
Yes.
And they talked about providing a push infrastructure so that you could register something so that, you know, my Apple servers would push stuff down to your app. But and they never actually released that.
That didn't get implemented, yeah.
Oh, okay. Because I remember that
big sort of mystery.
Okay. Because the idea was like you would get a message that would wake up your app, kind of like a wake on LAN for a network device.
Kind of the way push email works.
And this is totally rumor and conjecture, but it's something I saw today. They announced the 3.0 operating system is likely to have that feature. So that may be upcoming here shortly.
One of the things that's always kind of impressed me mostly about iPhone apps, because that's where I have more experience, but probably true about Mac apps too, is the sort of level of the user interaction, user interface sort of polish on average is much higher than the average Windows app. Even these 99-cent apps, you know, in the App Store tend to be just have a sort of a nicer UI look and feel and interaction. And I'm not clear how much of that is sort of the framework gives you all the tools you need to do that really easily, or is it just the Mac community takes that sort of more to heart than the Windows community does? I'm wondering if you have any sort of thoughts on that.
Yeah, it's actually both and a little bit more. And that's really one of the aspects that really drew me to going down this path in the first place is, you know, Windows is a workhorse, and there's a ton of Windows apps out there, and there's a lot of people writing Windows apps. But let's be honest, a lot of them are god-awful in usability and look. And that's just not the case with most Mac and iPhone apps. And what I'm finding is, first of all, Apple is, on the iPhone level at least, because that's what they can control, they're very strict about conforming to what they call the human interface guidelines, which are published on the Apple developer website. So there are things that your app is expected to do. If it has that table looking view, then it's expected to have, you know, the swipe motion to bring up an action, and it's expected to you know, if you have the clock thing, it's expected to scroll with acceleration, and like they're pretty strict about it. They want to establish a look and feel that matches the design of the device itself. You get those tools built right into Interface Builder. So one thing I haven't seen yet is this concept of a third-party company providing controls and control suites for Mac development or iPhone development. And that's everywhere in Windows, right? Because what do we get out of the box in Windows Forms is a bunch of gray buttons and stuff. And so, like, there's this whole industry of control and tool vendors, and they're all doing their own thing with different ways to interact with things and different ways to make things look. And it's just not happening with Mac development. You use what's in Interface Builder. The stuff that's in Interface Builder for Cocoa Apps is different than the stuff that's in Interface Builder for Cocoa Touch Apps, and they conform to the human interface guidelines, and they are what they Apple thinks they're supposed to be. And the community has bought into that 100% to the point where I've seen times when things have been released, Mac apps have been released out into the wild, and if the usability is not there, or you know, even if the icon, if there's not a nice icon to go on the dock, it is shunned by the community.
How does the Delicious Library, did you already mention that, or how does Delicious Library fit into that sort of thing? That, is that one of the few areas where there is kind of like a add-on control that people actually like?
Yeah, that's, I haven't used it yet, but that is one of those things that it kind of provides some common Mac-oriented controls. But again, they're very much, everything is very Mac-y, right? It's very Apple-y. So there's no going off onto your own and skinning controls to look all crazy and whatnot.
But what if I want a data grid? Or let me ask a different question. What if I want to create Web 2.0 applications with Web 1.0 controls? Can you do that? Never mind.
No, I got that. That was good.
Actually, that does lead me to, is there any, I mean, what's the web development world for Mac? Are people doing, I mean, is it all Rails these days? Are people doing like web objects? Or what's the kind of standard way of doing web development there?
I think probably it's mostly all Rails. I haven't delved into that aspect, the web objects thing, at all.
Okay.
So one of the things that I've been intrigued with, or potentially intrigued with, because it doesn't actually exist yet, is the notion of using Mono for iPhone development. You know, they've sort of got pieces of it, but it's not all wrapped up yet. And, you know, the ability to do, I mean, I guess you can do Cocoa development in C#, not on the iPhone yet natively, but maybe at some point soon. Is that something you've looked at all? Have you, you know, is it something you'd be interested in, or you think sticking with the native Objective-C is kind of the smarter way to go?
Well, it is something I've looked at and have a bit of a passing interest in, you know, just because I have a lot of C# experience, right? So right now, and I cannot speak to the current state of Mono at all, but actually had a chance to talk to Miguel de Casa a couple weeks ago at the Alt.net Seattle conference, and he was kind of catching us up on the state of Mono and iPhone and all of that. And there are games on the App Store right now for the iPhone that are written in C#, and they're running on Mono, and that's actually becoming pretty popular. There's this whole like game development toolkit.
Oh, is that Unity?
Unity, yes, Unity. That's the one. Do you know anything about that, Kevin? Do you want to talk about that a little?
No, that's about all I know. I mean, we've talked, you know, Miguel did some stuff about it at the PDC, but that it's sort of like this game toolkit that where the sort of the quote unquote scripting language for the, you know, the character logic and the game logic is C#.
Yeah, it's actually the scripting logic in Unity is Boo. It's like a JavaScript looking wrapper on top of Boo.
Oh wow, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, Miguel did a demo of that at Alt.net Seattle, and so the ecosystem around Mono and iPhone and Mac development is definitely growing, but it's all community driven right now, right? Because the Mono thing is Novell's thing, and you know they've got their Unix thing going on, and their interest doesn't really lie in Macintosh, right? So, but it's open source, so the community is driving it, and the iPhone thing, and the popularity of the iPhone, and the accessibility of the App Store, I think, is really driving a lot of interest toward the Mac development platform, both for Mono and C#, and native Objective-C stuff and Ruby. They're doing the Mac Ruby thing. I mean, everybody's looking at Mac right now, and I think a lot of that has to do with the iPhone.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would absolutely love to be able to just fire up Mono Develop and say project new, you know, iPhone app and start banging away in C Sharp and create a native iPhone app. It's just it's not there yet, but
I think it'll get there.
I certainly hope so. It sounds like they need to do all the Cocoa Touch bindings.
Yeah.
Which I'm sure is a big project.
It's a big project, and it's something that the community is going to have to take on. But right. Mono Develop is in beta for the Mac, and I am actually using it right now, and it's looking pretty good. I do a lot of my C# work on the Mac now instead of in a VM. So I only fire up my VM if I actually have to like build and run tests.
Yeah, I think that it's true that Novell's interest in Mono is mostly about, you know, furthering the Linux platform, but they do sell licenses for some, if you want a static compile, and in order to get code onto an iPhone, it's got to be static compiled. So I, as I understand it, that's one of the places that they actually make money off of, you know, off of Mono is to sell the license that static compiles. And I'm also seeing, you know, like in the way that like people want to buy games for iPhone, and there's kind of the promise of like people are actually writing games for Xbox in Mono as opposed to XNA because it frees you from some limitations there. So anyhow I think it'll be interesting to see gaming kind of push Mono and see where that goes, because there's, you know, potential of Novell selling licenses for static compiling, and already there's apps that are written that run on, you know, Xbox and Wii and iPhone and all that. And so
yeah, I think Mono is really a great story, and it's kind of like the tie that binds everything together here pretty soon. It's going to be real interesting to see how that all plays out between the different platforms. I'm pretty excited about it, to be honest.
Well, I've definitely learned a lot, and while we've been talking, I've been installing and upgrading Xcode. So I feel like this is kind of gives me enough to get started with it. So that's cool. I realize lately we don't do this enough, but is there any kind of anything you want to plug or, you know, anywhere you speaking or something you're selling or anything like that you want to talk about?
No. The thing I will plug something. In Tampa, Florida, there will be a Day of Ruby coming up in April, and that's at tampa.dayofruby.com. And so it's in May, I'm sorry. If you're in the area and you want to go to a great free Day of Ruby deep dive stuff, and there will be some Iron Ruby stuff in there too for the .NET guys, you should go definitely sign up and go see that. Other than that, I don't sell anything, so.
Even t-shirts? Nothing? Just kidding.
No.
Okay.
Follow me on Twitter.
Oh, right. Yes, at Scott C. Reynolds. Awesome. Okay, well, thanks a lot, Scott C. Reynolds. I definitely learned a lot, and hope our listeners did too.
Thanks for having me on.
All right, catch us next week on Herding Code.